Welcome to BB Lynch's Whips on BBC Sussex and BBC Surrey, the series where I meet six brilliant women who basically aren't 12 years old, who are whips. They are women who are hot, intelligent and in their prime. In this week's episode, we meet the woman the Telegraph calls the diva who put the sex into Sussex. BBC Radio describes her as the most sought-after singer on the planet, and the New York Times reckons she's opera's coolest soprano. Today, I'm meeting lyric soprano Danielle Denise. We interview Danielle in a rehearsal room, actually at Glyndebourne. But before you hear the chat, let's listen to Danielle Denise sing, and we've chosen this song, Vous êtes mon prochain, from the opera she's just starred in at Glyndebourne, because basically she recorded it in the organ room. She has an organ room. This has blown my mind. You live in Glyndebourne.
I do, yeah.
So I live in a rented studio flat, Danielle Denise.
My husband's family founded this festival. So yeah. When we fell in love, even when we started to, you know, our courtship, it was, yeah, I did have a vague idea that he's absolutely indelibly linked to this place. And so this is their family spot. And
does the oh my god ever go?
Do you know what's really funny is that I don't really see it in the way that I saw it when I first went there before Gus and I ever got together. I see it now as a place where we live, and it feels like home, and it sort of feels like the space that it is. Actually, it's only when I see it photographed, or I see somebody photograph me in it, and then I see what it looks like in a magazine spread, I sort of look through it and I go, good grief, like the house looks very, very big like that, doesn't it? But to me, it's based on our private part of the house where we live, yeah. That's home. And so I really only see it as home. And, yeah. You know, when you go through your own home, you sort of see all the cracks and everything. Yeah. So, yeah, I've never really had an oh my God moment.
Tell us the story, because I love this story, of the Glyndebourne love story, because you've kind of relived it.
Well, yeah, the first Glyndebourne love story was John Christie, Gus's grandfather, who loved to, you know, put on opera soirees and, you know, little evening salons in his house with his friends. And they would get, you know, the odd professional singer to come in and play some of the roles. And it was all a sort of jolly, jolly thing for them. But one day, Audrey Mildmay came to sing one of those roles. She was a Canadian-British soprano, and he fell head over heels in love with her. And I think Gus told me the other day he'd sort of taken her around and shown him his bedroom, and he said this is where we would sleep. And she said, oh, John, that's very presumptuous of you, you know, having just met the man. And but I think he did fall head over heels. And they then were married, and I think it was Audrey who famously said to John, who was, you know, contemplating building a theatre, oh, for God's sake, John, if you're going to do it properly, you know, do it right. And so Glyndebourne was built. And I mean, it is in a way like a sort of a testament to their love, a testament to their dedication to the arts, to music, to each other. You know, the shortest one is that he built it so that she'd perform there, and she wouldn't have to sort of go around singing all over the place. And yeah, but it is now, gosh, now it's 85 years old, Glyndebourne, and there's a huge legacy that has been created by the Christies, by John, then his son George, and now Gus.
So you were born in Australia.
Yes.
Your parents are from Sri Lanka.
My parents were born in Sri Lanka. They're mixed with Dutch and Scottish heritage. They met in Australia. I was born there. My brother was born there. We moved to America when I was 10 and he was 8. And I continued my studying there. I already knew from 8 that I wanted to be an opera singer.
How?
Because I was taking singing and dancing lessons. Like most kids, you put your little girls in, you know, song and dance and talent school and that kind of thing. And I was doing jazz and ballet and tap dance and singing and, you know, doing things like pop music and musical theater. And at a certain point, the teachers were very, very enthusiastic to my parents, you know, about what I could accomplish and what potential I had. And they had thought to themselves, you know, we should get her, you know, proper singing teacher, a voice teacher that can give her some technique, some classical technique. So she's not just relying on Mother Nature and sort of winging it everywhere she goes, which is an amazing thing for parents to think. And they looked and looked. My mom really searched high and low, couldn't find a teacher that would take on an 8-year-old to train classically.
But why did you think? Why did you know you wanted to do classic rather than pop?
Well, it was when I took those lessons that I felt an affinity with the way that I could produce a classical sound to train my voice. That I thought, well, all of my friends can sing and dance and act, and they're doing all of this, but none of them can do this. And I really did feel that. I wasn't probably able to articulate it like that when I was 8. The way I articulated it was I drew a picture of a girl wearing a poofy dress standing all alone on the stage with big, you know, theater curtains, you know, which looked like the little Jane curtains like on your dollhouse. And I drew that picture for my mum and I said, this is what I want to be. I want to be an opera singer. So, you know, I did fall in love with it and determined that of all the things that I could do, this was the one that I felt would be most me.
Yeah, most authentic. So this series that you're kindly taking part in is called Whips, and that's women who are hot, intelligent in their prime. So congratulations.
Wow. Thank you.
Thank you. Your lower end, you're 40, you've just scraped through. You're a young thing. You've lived and worked around the world.
Yes.
And I really want to know, is there a country where you think older women are most celebrated in?
Ah, well, that's really interesting because I always feel that sort of Eastern Asian culture like has much more sort of like, you know, the elderly people in the family are the hugely respected members of the clan. You know, that Asian cultures have more sort of respect for their elders. They don't look at their elderly people as a burden.
Yeah.
And
when can we get rid?
That, or gosh, you know, my mom's called again. She pulled. I remember, I'll never forget an American friend of mine saying to me, oh my God, I've got to get off the phone. My nana's just fallen down the stairs again and hit her head and we've got to go back to our house again. And I just thought, oh my God. You know, I really was shocked by this attitude towards, and I'm not saying that one person personifies an entire, you know, culture of people. But I definitely have, you know, noticed that Asian cultures have a huge respect for our elders, for the elderly, and, you know, men and women. But I'm trying to think of countries where the women are sort of really
I'm going to say Italy.
Yeah, I was thinking Italy myself. La mamma, la mamma, la mamma. You know, the mamma is like the center of everything. I would say that's the same in Sri Lankan culture as well.
Yeah.
I feel that Sri Lankan culture is very much... I feel like Sri Lankan culture... When I had Jewish friends when I was a kid in Los Angeles, I always felt like it was exactly the same as Sri Lankan culture. And, you know, within all the time that I've spent in Italy, and I've spent a lot of time there... Again, quite similar to Sri Lankan culture.
Strong women.
Yeah, strong women, and women who would do anything for family, you know? Anything and everything. I quite like that.
Your mum, she's your style icon.
She is completely my icon.
Shop for you.
When I say my mum shops for me, I don't mean that I say to my mum, Mum, can you go shopping for me? But what I mean is that I don't often have time to go shopping. My mum, knowing that, will go to the department stores, like, you know, in America, Neiman Marcus or somewhere like that, and go and actively seek things out that she might spot that suit me, that you know, is a find. And she will ring me up and say, God, I found this thing for you. You're going to love it. And, I mean, for me, it's a very awesome thing, you know, to have a mother who has such impeccable taste, to have a mother who I have a really good relationship with, because I also didn't really realize that mothers and daughters can have strained relationships until I grew up. When I was a kid, the only weird mother-daughter relationship that I remember was one I saw on TV on Friends, where, you know, the Courtney Cox's character was always like, Mom, like, oh, like it was a weird relationship. And I thought, oh, that's just there for comedic value. And then I grew up and I saw that people actually have these very odd relationships with their mothers, and that when they think of their mothers or they have to go see their mothers, they roll their eyes. And I knew nothing of this. I could not relate to that. And so it's only once I grew up that I really understood how rare it is to have a mother who you really view as your best friend and who is somebody who you can tell about everything, but who you can trust, but also somebody who you know loves you so unconditionally that you can ask them for their honest truth about you, what you do on the stage, which is what the relationship I have with my mom, or how I sing. And I know what she tells me will come from a place of love. So I have no, like, tension over the critique.
Will she critique?
Of course, if I ask her to. Yeah. My mom comes, you know, my parents fly out before I open my shows. They don't come just for the premiere. They come for the week before. And I'll sit with them. I'll put them in the audience. My mom has a notepad. My dad, if he's allowed to, he'll, you know, take a little film with his phone of a scene here or there. And I go through these notes with my mom after, you know, and we laugh and laugh because she writes them in the dark and her vision's not so as good as it used to be. And she always says, oh my God, I don't have eyes to even write, but I try my best. And so she's there writing, and then we look at the notes after and they've gone all funny and, you know, they're all crooked. But, you know, there's just golden nuggets of information that is my way of being able to judge myself from the outside. This great singer who I studied with for a small moment in time when I was 13 at the Tanglewood Institute, she was called Phyllis Curtin, and she said, you can't be the singer and the judge at the same time. You have to be the singer and let us judge. And that stuck with me a lot. It's really hard to do that because the very first thing you do when you open your mouth is listen to it. And the very first thing you want to do is judge yourself. And so I can't say that I do this, you know, without fail. I am so incredibly fallible in terms of judging myself, and I judge myself all the time. I'm probably too much, actually. If I was giving myself advice, I would advise myself to just take it easy, you know? But it's really hard to do when you always want to do your best. And the great thing about having my mom in the audience is that I can just be, and then she and I can sit down, look at a video, or look at her notes, and she, you know, she can say, what were you doing in this scene? I didn't really understand what that was. Or I can say to her, Mom, when I did this bit, I was going for this, but did that come across that way? And she'll say, no, I thought you meant were this. And I'll go, okay, so now I've understood something about the way I'm physicalizing my emotion, that's not reading the right way. Because it's not enough to feel something on the stage. It's got to be transmitted across. Yeah. And part of that transmission is like It's like a language in a way. So, you know, understanding how your physicality is perceived is a very important part of that language being translatable to the audience.
And it must be really lovely for your mum as well. That kind of is full circle, isn't it? And she's really involved.
Yeah.
In what she helped create.
Yeah. And you know, yeah.
She sold the lessons.
Well, you're so wonderful to say that. You're so wonderful to say that because I met a sculptress in Baltimore, the daughter of a very, very, very famous cellist. And I was rehearsing at her house before a concert because she had very kindly said to the series I was performing in, you know, if anyone needs a piano, they can use my house. I went to the sculptress's house. Amazing, lovely lady. And my parents came with me because they'd come for the concert and I wanted them to come and hear my rehearsal. And so they came in, so they sat with me, we did a little bit and we took a break. And we went to meet the lady. So the lady came and she said, we introduced ourselves. And my parents had seen her sculptures out in the garden and they said to her, we love your work. And she said, I love your work. And they said, what do you mean? And she went, she just stretched out her hand and pointed at me. And for my parents, that was, you know, I mean, in a way, like a eureka moment. But I mean, that no one had ever expressed to them that sentiment that they feel so naturally, which is a deep parental love, so much so that you would move mountains to help your child. No one had expressed that to them as like their greatest accomplishment, their work, their legacy. You know, most people would say, oh, they worked a regular job and then gave everything to me so I could make it, you know. But this lady looked at them and went, this is your work. This is your...
I love that.
Your feat, you know. Well, it's really
musical?
Cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. Are they musical?
My mom, hugely. So she's my first teacher. She's the person who I first practiced with before I even took those classical voice lessons. She sat in every voice lesson I took until I was 18 years old.
Oh.
For 10 years, she sat in every single voice lesson so that she could listen to what the teacher was teaching me and help me to apply it when I was at home. So there's a huge dedication from my parents. And the really cool thing about my mom and dad is that they've never held that above me as a reason why I need to, you know,
and
focus or whatever.
Do you
know,
they've not. Baltimore?
Yeah, they've never said that. They've always said, you know, if ever you get tired of this and you want to quit or whatever, you know, you must do what makes you happy. They've done it, you know, in that wonderfully unconditional way. That isn't always the case with musicians who start very young. You know, you often hear stories of musicians whose parents were absolutely relentless with them.
Yeah.
Or I have many friends who's, you know, instrumentalists whose parents didn't let them watch TV, didn't let them listen to the Top 40. You know,
Top 40.
Yeah, didn't let them, you know, listen to radio, pop music, you know. And I was very fortunate that I got to live, you know, in the world and live a normal-ish life, you know.
Despite winning an Emmy at 16, lady, what the hell's that about?
I know. I won an Emmy when I was 16 for presenting a television show. And it's really amazing to now have come back to presenting at this stage in my career because it is really, I mean, it's really coming full circle for me in that sense. It's closing the circle. I hosted a television show because I was featured on the show at first. And then the producer saw me on camera and thought, what if I make the guest host for these shows a child instead of an adult? And hence, I became a guest host for all the special series on this show called LA Kids, which was essentially, I mean, it's a little bit like the arts show or something like that. It's a little bit like an all-rounders arts and cultural showcase, but televised and for children. Which is pretty cool.
It's pretty cool. I want a gig, but I may be too old.
which
other whips have influenced your life? So your mum, obviously. Are there any other women?
Mum, hugely. The singer that I most followed when I was young and who is still, you know, my idol to this day is Dame Kiri Takanawa. She was massive when I was growing up in Australia. And she had won this competition called the Sun Aria competition. And that was a competition happening in Australia, you know, when I was a kid. I remember my mum and dad saying to me, Kiri is from New Zealand, you're from Australia. Kiri has a mixed background, just like you. And Kiri won the Sun Aria competition. So one day you might win the Sun Aria competition. And she was a real role model in that sense. She was somebody who represented somebody similar to me who was out there doing it. And, you know, I really, I made a show last year for the BBC on forgotten female composers, and it was called Unsung Heroines. And one of the things that we looked at a lot is that part of the way in which women in these previous generations, I'm talking 200 and 300 years even, were inhibited or even, you know, insecure about their own thoughts about their own talent was because they had no examples who came before them.
Yeah.
There wasn't anyone around them that they could say, well, this person did this so I could do this. They really were these lone rangers, you know, filled with, you know, some filled with self-doubt, and some, you know, like Hildegard von Bingen, who, you know, found freedom inside the monastery. That was the only place she could study and learn and sing and preach and exist in the way that she wanted to exist, because outside of the confines of the church, women weren't even allowed to sing at church.
Did you meet her?
Hildegard?
No, Dankiri.
I met someone quite like Hildegard. She was wonderful. Sister Lydia.
Tell me about Sister Lydia.
So great. She was teaching me to sing, you know, some of the chants, and we were looking at their music, you know, the very, very old style music was written very, very differently from the way that we read music now. And this great segment of me singing with her and her kind of looking at me quite sternly and going, she was great. She was wonderful. Dame Kiri, I did meet. I met Dame Kiri in 2008 for the first time, and oh my God, I was beside myself. And it was the only person I would have really been starstruck around, really. When you consider that I grew up in LA with a lot of celebrities, yeah, it's impressive. And and she said to me, can I tell you what the three most important things you should think about are? And I was seated on her sofa with my legs like perfectly crossed, and you know, I was thinking, what is she going to say to me? And she said, me, me, and me. And she said, you should be thinking about only yourself. And the reason is because if you don't take care of your voice or yourself and what you need in order to be able to succeed and do well, nobody else is going to. Everybody's going to pull at you and drag you from pillar to post. And if you keep giving, they will take. And, you know, my mom, of course, says this to me a lot as well, because she's always, you know, she's coming at it from a perspective of, you know, I'm worried about you overstretching yourself. Dame Kiri was giving me the perspective from a singer who has been there, right in that position where, you know, she had to prioritize herself, because this thing is an instrument that doesn't last if you mess around with it.
Were you, is this true that when you were pregnant, the latter stages, your voice went?
Yes.
How does that, is that
my voice got really husky. I think what happened was my whole body was full of fluid. And so similarly, my vocal cords were full of fluid. It was just like a tissue that had fluid around it. And I sounded incredibly husky, like incredibly husky. And I mean, I sound a little bit husky today because I've got a bit of allergy, but I sounded 1,000 times more husky and squeaky husky. And I thought it was quite funny at first, because I thought I sounded like James Bond, you know, like one of those Bond ladies. I thought, well, that'd be quite cool, like James, you know, but
it came back.
It did come back, yeah, but it didn't come back straight away. It took a few weeks.
Yeah,
but I was okay. And you know, I went back to work after 3 weeks and 3 days, and I premiered an opera when he was only 7.5 weeks old, 8 weeks old.
Blimey.
Yeah, it was intense. It was an euphoric period in my life.
Did your baby come out loving opera?
I don't know. Yeah, probably. I mean, his mum is a singer. So he's, you know, he loves music.
Yeah.
He absolutely adores music. And he's quite obsessive about music in the way that I am. When I love a piece of music or get to know a piece of music, I need to listen to it sort of over and over and over again. And it's so funny to see him be exactly the same. And we think, oh my God, he wants to hear that song again. You know? But I just think, well, actually, I'm exactly the same. So that I, you know.
I want to ask you one more thing about Dame Kiri. It was interesting. You said that she wasn't just a role model in that, you know, she was a woman doing this, and she was from New Zealand, you were from Australia, but the mixed race, the mixed heritage aspect. I guess that's a big deal in opera, trying to break into opera.
Yeah, it's funny because at the time, it wasn't that there wasn't any mixed race people, so therefore I had to look to Dame Kiri. It was just interesting that Dame Kiri had a mixed ethnic heritage, and so did I. So there, I actually didn't take it in as the way that I took it in as a child was the way that you would say, and Dame Kiri's favorite color is blue, and so is yours. You know, I took it in as like a commonality rather than the only way that you could see a future for yourself is if Dame Kiri was there, because otherwise there's only white people around her. I didn't really see any of that.
Yeah.
I had no color barriers when I was young. I wasn't taught that color or ethnicity or anything could impede me, because I was in a world where music triumphs, you know, over everything, and talent triumphs over everything. And so I just didn't understand that whether there was less or more of me. I mean, yeah, I look back now and I think, okay, I probably was the only darker skinned child doing all the Ice Deadfords in Australia. But at the time I didn't notice it. So I, you know, continued on happy as ever and, you know, looking forward. Yeah.
Dame Kiri is obviously a whip whom you admire. We ask our guests to think of a track or a music whip that inspired them. I mean, would it be Dame Kiri, or is there any other contemporary artists that you like?
Well, I loved Whitney Houston. She was another person who I really, really adored as a child and as an adult. And I really, really cried a lot when she died. She just had a most amazing voice. The most amazing voice that you could listen to forever and ever and ever. Like Kiri. Her music made you feel really good, you know? Madonna was another one I was really into when I was a kid. And she really made you feel good, you know? I used to love listening to Dress You Up in My Love. And I looked like Madonna sometimes when I was a kid. I had cut-out gloves. I had frilly skirts, leg warmers, crimped hair. The lot. Yeah, I really, you know, love that. I love that. And that, to me, at that time, that kind of overt joy for just being a girl was something I sensed even as a kid.
You're listening to BB Lynch's Whips on BBC Sussex and BBC Surrey. And we're chatting this week to lyric soprano Danielle Denise at Glyndebourne. And right now, I'm going to hit her with some fantastic quotes about her.
So these are some great quotes about you that I just love. I wonder if you like these.
Okay.
I'm going to read them out of you. So what do you think?
Kind of thing.
Look like a pop diva, sings like a real one.
Yeah, I love
that
one.
That's nice. A diva for the 21st century.
Yeah, I like that
Beautiful.
One too.
Beautiful. A diva for the digital age.
Yes, nice. I like that one too.
I love this one. The Telegraph calls you, Danielle Denise. The diva who puts the sex into Sussex.
Oh, yeah, that's a funny one.
That's
isn't
a big
it?
County. That's I a mean, lot of sex.
That's because of Cleopatra. That's because of what I did with Cleopatra. And the funny thing is, I mean, that just tells you miles about what the power is of suggestion, because I didn't take my clothes off for Cleopatra.
That's good.
I showed nothing. But the way in which I exuded the character was enough to get everybody hot under the collar.
Yeah.
But I didn't show anything. Whereas I know other people where they've gone naked in opera.
And you know, no one said
full
sexy.
Frontal. No, they've done it. It's been sexy or whatever. But I mean, it's, you know, I've always thought I couldn't do that. I have too many, you know, I have too much body insecurity to sort of go naked, you know. But I also don't wonder whether you need to.
You don't need to.
I don't think so.
Diva equals whip, doesn't it? I like that. I think there's a real comparison. Do you think, so you're saying that your voice changes and you're prepared for that in a way that you're doing some charity work or lots of charity work and you've got lots of other things going on, so there'd be legacies. But aren't you at a prime age where you can make make a difference in opera, in how it will be seen in the future?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I hope that's the case, and all of the work that I do on television speaks to that end. You know, I really want to do my absolute best. You know, I really don't want to sit around, you know, at opera conferences, you know, lamenting the state of the opera world and saying, you know, what's happening to our dwindling audiences. I get out there and do your bit, and that's what I'm doing. And you know,
how do you do it? How do you make it relevant to younger people?
Interesting question. I don't do anything to change it. I just continue to be me. So when I talk to kids about opera, I just tell them my story, how I came to it, and what I think about opera, and what I think about its transformative power, and what I think is unique about it, like the fact that it's one of the only unamplified experiences we can have today of vocal music, because so much else of what we experience is amplified, or comes through a box. You know, even the greatest Madonna show at the O2 or whatever, it's going to be coming at you through an artificial box. And the human voice is an amazing instrument. So to come at you live, you know, to touch the little hairs on your skin, you know, the sound of a human voice, it's a powerful thing, and it can be very emotional and overwhelming. So to make it relevant, the only thing I do is continue to do it, and do it with the ethics and the aesthetics that I think are really important as an artist. So I just bring what I think is important to opera. So for me, I don't view an operatic performance as a opportunity to exhibit the sound of my voice. I view it as a theatrical performance. I view it as an opportunity to share a story with the audience, to have that connectivity between a performer and their audience through storytelling. And everything I do on stage is in the service of that, even if it goes wrong. To me, that is why I love live performance. I don't want to be a hero in the dressing room, you know, or yeah, we all sing nice performances when we rehearse in the empty theaters. They don't mean anything until somebody receives it and responds to it and is moved by it. And I thought about this a lot this year. I don't want to just show people my voice or even only entertain people. I want to move people. I want people to feel something when they see or and hear me perform. I don't want them to watch me perform. And so I felt that in a way, even though I'm articulating that now, that that's the way that I've always been. And my biggest goal in life is to just continue to do that and not let that goalpost change.
Mm. You never want to dilute what you're doing either to make it more accessible, do you?
No, I don't think. I think when something's really good, it doesn't. You don't have to.
Yeah.
I will. What's unique about me is that I have experience singing lots of other different types of music. So it means that I can run the gamut from, you know, I can do a concert and I can start with Handel and I can end with Hammerstein, and I can go all the way through to Broadway musical theater, authentically and legitimately. Mm. You know, it makes my concerts really exciting. It makes people feel like they're getting two or three concerts for the price of one. It makes people feel comfortable in all the rep that I'm doing because they feel they're hearing different sides of me that sound very genuine and real in the rep. So I don't sound like an opera singer singing as time goes by. And I don't sound like a musical theater singer trying to sort of blag their way through, you know, Pagliacci or whatever, you know.
But that's the perfect way to do it then, because it's like the gateway drug to opera. Do you know what I mean? If people feel that they won't like opera, they can't approach opera, it feels like they're not their world, this is a great way to get them in, isn't
Completely.
It? Can I just say a word, a name to you?
Yes.
LL Cool J.
Oh, LL Cool J, yes. I sang with him. I sang a duet with him. But it's so funny because that was a perfect example of what happens when you don't succumb to the barriers or cliches that you think people will perceive about opera. So I was scouted by them. LL Cool J wanted to do a duet with me. So they looked me up, thought I was great, and phoned me up and asked me to do this. So I went there going, I've been asked to do a duet collaboration with LL Cool J. Somebody in some creative think tank that was drawing up a storyboard for this duet thought that what would be really cool was if I represented like time gone by, if I represented like opera stuck in time, like la 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 la, I'm just this like opera singer waving my hands and I am lost in time, and then LL Cool J comes and he's like, you know, and says like, I'm translating what she's saying in a foreign language to today's time. So somebody wrote that storyboard up and forgot to tell me. So brilliant that they forgot, because I got there and he started doing his like rapping and I was kind of going, oh really? Well, listen to this. La 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 la. And I was singing and he was kind of looking at me like, wow, you know, and it became like one of those Grammy duets where you get like with Beyonce and Willie Nelson or something, where you get a complete fusion of two different people who are strong in their métiers, who believe in the music they do, saying, let's fuse, let's make something different together. And the whole scene took a very different shape as a result of, thank God, me not getting that storyboard, you know, but
Well, the moral there is never check your email.
Yeah, right.
But that's perfect, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, no, and it was brilliant. And we really got on really well. And, you know, we're talking about hip opera and stuff like that. And
yeah.
He's a wonderful guy. And, I was thrilled to get a chance to do a duet with somebody like LL Cool J. And especially to meet him, to have it be LL Cool J himself, who's one of the sort of godfathers of rap. It's really cool.
Yeah, and Stormzy's a fan.
Well, yeah, I would love to do something with Stormzy. I would love to meet him more and sort of do stuff. We've run into each other at the South Bank Awards and things like that. And Melvin Bragg, he came up to me after my performance and he said, Stormzy really loved you. And he was like, I think you guys should do something together. And, you know, we're going to set that up. And so, yeah, I don't know. We'll see if ever Stormzy finds us a place for opera with Graham. It would be really cool.
His Glastonbury set was still gives me goosebumps.
Epic. It was amazing.
I think I cried three times.
Wow.
Maybe four. No, I know. I'm very much a woman. Do you think it's easier to be a whip in opera? Is it more acceptable? Are you respecting, I'm guessing it as musical genres go, opera would be one of the ones that you're allowed to be mature in.
Yeah, opera is less ageist in the sense. I mean, it does eventually, like the film world or anything. But I mean, because you mature so much later, there's a lot of room for you to sort of season. Yeah, I think it's great to be an opera singer doing what I do. I would definitely say that in the earlier years of your career as a woman, you probably need to, you know, I would say that there's certain things I could do now in my career that I wouldn't have done earlier, like some of the crossover performances that I'm doing, where if I'd done them earlier and done too many of them, some people in the purist opera community would have thought, she's not very serious. Now, part of that would have been that they would have looked at my look, which is a little unfair. You know, they would have looked at my look and categorized me and gone, oh, she's a glamorous, young, talented singer, and she's going that route. Oh, gosh. Another one bites the dust. Which would have been an unfair assessment because if you ask anyone in the business, one of the most serious musicians. But it's interesting because I'm still young, but I'm no longer the youngest in everything. And I spent a lot of my years, I spent 25 years being the youngest, you know, in everything. So, but I always felt that was a phase, that was a part of my career, which was lovely, but I never, even in my 20s and 30s, I never sought to still try to be the youngest to do this or the youngest to do that. I looked at that phase as an opportunity of having time on my side to then make cautious decisions so that I wouldn't do anything to jimmy things, you know?
So you really had a wise head on. You were
very
really,
wise, yeah. Really, I mean, I'm not saying I really had a very wise head on, but I mean, I took very wise, very carefully thought out decisions because longevity is what I want. I want to be singing at 60, you know? Yeah. And that's not to say that I would...
Say a higher age because 60 isn't that far away from me. Say something that's...
I want to be singing at 600.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I do want to keep singing as long as I can and I don't want to be a flash in the pan. And these days, careers sometimes, they sort of blitz out for like 5 or 6 years and then, some bad decisions are made. Mm-hmm. And your vocal cords are like that, you know, that rubber band you have in your office that you can't really use anymore because it's slightly got overstretched and it's got those little white lines through it. That's what a vocal cord will be like if you overuse it or abuse it or sing the wrong repertoire. It's like a, it's like an elastic band that lost its mojo.
And you can't get this fit. You couldn't get it fixed.
No. And you can replace a piano or a violin or an oboe. Oh. Get a new part if you break it, if it breaks, if somebody, you know. But in singing, you have to think all the time, wherever you go. Right now, I'm looking at the wind outside this window, and I'm thinking, I'm not going to go outside in the garden later because I don't want to be standing out in the wind when I have an allergy at the moment. You know? It's very high maintenance singing. I don't recommend it, you know, unless you really, really love it.
Do you? And you do.
Yeah, I do.
Do you see age as a barrier or a gift?
Let me ask you this. Is the question whether I see age as a barrier or a gift, or whether I see aging as a barrier or a gift?
Aging.
I see aging as something inevitable, which I feel like women, we have a lot more stuff to face when it comes to aging, because men, when they age, they look more distinguished, they look more rugged, they look more fill in the blank, but it's always positive. And with women, you know, when you see women aging, people tend to have quite a high standard they hold women to. And navigating that, I think, for any woman is something, it's there, even if you say, I don't care, but it's still there. And my nana always taught me to take really good care of my skin. I mean, she took care of her skin, and my mom then taught me what her nana, what her mom taught her, to take care of skin. So I do try to take care of my skin. I think I have some good genes, so hopefully that helps with aging. What I think, though, is that you probably will look a hell of a lot more beautiful as you age if you're happy with yourself and if you feel beautiful. I think that if you're so worried about it that you can't feel confident about yourself because of the way you're aging, I think that probably shows. And then you would feel less beautiful, so you would look less beautiful.
And that is really hard to straddle, but I do think, oh, I mean, I hope so, that you get more confident in that you kind of care less, and that's freedom.
Yeah.
Because you still want to look, you still want to look great, but you kind of, but you know you've got everything else to offer.
Yeah, and also off. Like, you know, I think when women say like we care less, I think somebody else might look at that and go, so you don't care about yourself, you don't want to put yourself together at all. But it's not that. It's about sort of like, it's not caring about how somebody else might perceive your aging to be. So it's going, you know, and actually the people who I've met who even, you know, I can think of five or so people I've met where regardless of what their actual skin looked like, whether it was full of wrinkles or not, they had tremendous beauty and confidence. They wore wonderful clothes and makeup. They looked, you know, fabulous because they felt fabulous. Yeah. And they exuded that. And I really looked at that and I thought, I see you even as more beautiful as a result of the way that you feel.
Yeah.
And I was really impressed with that. Yeah. And I thought that's hugely attractive to me, even in a woman.
Yeah.
If you see a woman who's comfortable in their skin, that is just so attractive.
It, isn't
yeah,
it?
It's That's so wonderful. It. You just you as a fellow woman, you would see them as even more beautiful, yeah. You know?
Who are the future whips? Who do you see young women in any field, so music or just the world, politics, and you're like, yeah, they're impressive.
I'm quite impressed with a little girl called Greta Thunberg, who is actually, I've just discovered, the daughter of a friend of mine.
Stop it.
Yeah, because I've worked with a singer called Malena Ehrenmann, who's a fantastic singer. We've done quite a few shows together. And I mentioned Greta to somebody, and they went, you know, that's Malena's daughter. And I didn't know what Malena's married name was, so I hadn't clocked it at all.
I knew you were going to say Greta.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really impressed with her because, you know, we've just had this Google conference where they talked about the 114 jets or whatever that showed up. And there's little Greta trying to figure out how to get to New York by yacht, solar-powered yacht, because she wants to go to speak at some very important conference but wants to send the right message about, you know, conserving the earth. And she's gone to those lengths to get to New York. So I think she's a future whip, absolutely. And I think I met a lot of fantastic women who work at the International Rescue Committee, of which I'm an ambassador. So that is founded by Albert Einstein to help people flee conflict. So it's not only refugees, but you know, any kind of person fleeing war-torn cities or any kind of conflict at all, really. Could be child labor. You know, I kicked off an anti-child labor campaign in Tanzania, and you know, the things that I saw, you know, I were really, you know, grueling to see children going through these kinds of predicaments where they have to make these emotional evaluations. And a lot of the women that I saw working for them are just incredible. You know, they are people who are the whips of now, who you know, are the unsung heroes, really, because they are on the ground. They're not getting the Nobel Prize or, you know, cover of Vogue or whatever. You know, they're on the ground, you know, doing these things regardless of whether anyone spotlights them.
Doing it because they're doing it.
Yeah, they're doing it because it truly means something to them. And that's incredible, you know. Yeah. I really loved meeting all of them. And the men who work there as well. So what are they called? They're mahips.
Dips. Drips. We'll work on that. We'll do that as another series. It doesn't matter. What's coming up for you? You about to play Cleopatra again?
Yeah. Ooh. I'm about to go to La Scala to make my debut at Teatro La Scala as Cleopatra. So I'm returning to a role that has become, you know, was for me an iconic role, an instant icon in the Julius Caesar that happened here at Glanbourne. And I'm returning to it a few years older and wiser.
And what are you going to... And how's that going to...
Well, it's really interesting because you won't believe this, but a lot of people in the business, not a lot, but, you know, when you get told something like this, it feels like a lot because even if it's one person, it's annoying. But, yeah, people in the business have said things like, would she do Cleopatra again? Because, I mean, how... Would she couldn't possibly, you know, have more success in it than she did in the David McVicar production. Now, that's not a wrong thing to say, except for the fact that, you know, for example, Beverly Sills, this wonderful American soprano, was 38 when she did her first Cleopatra. I think maybe 37 when she did her first Cleopatra. So, you know, there's a lot of growing that I would do as an artist over my 30s to say that there's still something I have to give in this role. Mm. And Lord knows what else there is to find. It's a treasure trove of a piece and a role. And I'm really looking forward to visiting again. I'm not trying to compare it to my previous Cleopatra, but I am a, you know, more grown woman than I was before. So there will be other things there.
This is the thing about whips. You've got the whips Cleopatra going on here. This is brilliant.
Yeah.
So compared, I think it would be really interesting to see after the event how the two differ.
Yeah.
What stature you're bringing to it now. More so.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, I feel like I would probably be sexy in a really different way. A really different kind of sexiness to
sexy with
ingenue
bad back.
Sexiness.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Yeah, I'm excited for it.
I'm excited for it.
You should come.
I'll definitely come.
Because, you know, Milan, you can get booed at Milan. American singers have been booed in Milan. It's booed. A big lion's den of the sort of the conoscenti of the Italians. And so, you know, everybody's going, isn't that exciting? And I'm going, yes, exciting and slightly daunting. But I'm very excited to go. And, you know, I think it will be an adventure. It will be a sort of crazy adventure.
Really, when is it?
For it. I leave in mid-September, and we open in mid-October.
This isn't a question, I just need to say it to you. I read this about you in the Mail. She doesn't own a T-shirt, and even her dressing gown has a train. That's the best thing I've ever... Please say it's true. Is it? I don't even care if it isn't true.
No, it's true. Wow. Yeah. No, I did a lot of research into my dressing gown because I wanted one that was going to have like long sleeves and that I could flow around the house. I wanted to float. And my mom actually found it for me. You wouldn't believe it. My mom found it for me. My husband tried to buy me a version of it. And oh my goodness, it's hilarious. So he went, I showed him all my reference shots too. I was like, this is what I'm, showed him all these glamour starlets of the 40s. And so I was, this is what I'm thinking. And he gave me a Christmas present. I'm like, I think I've got the dressing gown. And it was a delicious, and I wear it all the time, red, fluffy Terry wardrobe, which I love, you know, I love it. Like, I love it. I wear it a lot. But it was so funny. I was going like, I love it. But this is not exactly what I meant by like diva floating around the stairs kind of dressing gown. So funny. But you know, I did. My mum then cracked it. She found an amazing one, which most people think is a dress.
This is so funny.
So yeah, no, I do love. I love dressing up. I love fashion.
You're a diva stroke whip. You're allowed to wear what you want.
Do you know what I'm proud of? Is I'm proud that. And I remember when I did my albums, you know, this was a really big thing, was I didn't want anything that I put out about me to not reflect me, who I actually am, you know. And there were opera singers who were, you know, all glammed up to the nines, but actually are more jeans and t-shirt type of people. But there they are wearing their, you know, massive gowns and loads of eye makeup that you never see them in when you meet them. And I was really keen that whatever image is going out there of me represents me as me. So the essence of me that lives on the inside to the outside is represented on the even further outside plastic packaging of anything that I do. And so I was really proud to stand behind that and kind of go, you know, my debut album, I'm wearing jeans. But they were very fashionable jeans. But, you know, they... No, they didn't have a train. But I wore a Donna Karan Icons blouse that was given to me by the designer.
Oh, stop it. And I just thought,
you know... And that was given to me by the man who designed it for Donna Karan. And I just thought, you know, yes, that's me. That's me, you know? And it's, you know, those are really... I feel proud of the fact that... If people see me and then they meet me, they go, I feel like I've met the person I already thought I would know, you know, that it's not, oh, she's completely different in real life as she is to her persona. I saved my personas for the stage, you know?
Thank you so much. Such a joy to meet
you. God, it's a pleasure.
Good luck, Cleopatra.
Oh, God.
Coming at you.
If you feel like coming to cheer me on in Milan.
Oh, yes, please.
Whips,
thank you.
Whips from all the whips of the world. Make your way to Milan on October 18th to cheer on, you know, a whip doing Cleopatra, who's another whip, by the way.
Yeah. Well, we think we've booked her.
So we are in the courtyard at Glyndebourne in the sunshine in front of a statue. We've just spoken to Danielle Denise.
Yeah.
How was she for you?
So Danielle Denise lives here, and I feel like we're so lucky to be here, and we're in the grounds, and we just went in her meadow. I just feel like I've had a little bit
of... she has a meadow.
She's got a meadow. It's not a euphemism. She's got an actual meadow. I feel like we've just been really lucky. And she had no time today. She's rehearsing and going, you know, starting a new rehearsal for something, and got a child to raise, and is running Glyndebourne, and blah, 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 and gave us time. And her voice wasn't very good, she said, although she sounded incredible. I just loved her. She's so interesting and so passionate. Are you passionate? Are you that passionate about anything?
I don't think I am, and
that saddens
me somewhat that had I been passionate about something, maybe I would have ended up somewhere like this.
We've got a statue. This is... I feel giddy that I'm here. She had a contained energy. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
I love that about her. Some people, there's like the whirlwind, and that's great as well. But there's something very contained and very in control. But I think she knows what she wants, and she's incredibly beautiful, incredibly talented, incredibly successful, but has worked for it and has gone for it. And I love what she had to say about getting older and seeing part of her role in getting older as making opera more accessible to everyone, which is because, you know, you haven't been, have you?
No, I've not. No, I feel ashamed. I should have come here, shouldn't I? Prior to today. So I could say I have been here.
Of course I've been to Glyndebourne, yeah. And I came when I was a kid. And why wouldn't you? Would you think opera just wasn't for you?
I think so. I think I totally understand the spectacle of it, and there are other kind of musical styles that I'm not necessarily a fan of, but you can appreciate the performance and the presentation of it. But no, I've never been to... this feels a little intimidating when you're amongst opera's people.
But we are her people now.
We're her people.
I feel that she really embraced us. Did you like Danielle?
I did, yeah. She was very... like you say, it's that passion and that drive to get her where she's here, and the fact that even though she is the lady of this manor and she's lived in amazing places and performed amazing roles in amazing performances, she seemed very down to earth and matter of fact about it all.
Yeah, and really approachable and really unafraid. And I really love that. I like that in our whips that we're interviewing. There's a fearlessness in them which I kind of try and hold on to and certainly want to grasp.
I'm just going to get a drink.
Oh, yeah, ice and lemon. Just ice and lemon for me, please. I'm on a diet. So that was Danielle Denise, and next week we will be talking to Loose Woman, Andrea McLean.